Hey everybody, my name's John and I'm an alcoholic. And I got sober on October 7th, 1987, and I was almost 22 years old. And back then, 21 or 22 doesn't seem kind of young to the kids coming in nowadays, where they're, you know, 14 and 15. There was, though, out in Desert Hot Springs, a teenager place where young kids came in a lot. I'll tell you, Sasha asked me if I was nervous, and I said a little bit, and she said, "No, you." And I said, "You know what? If I do so bad that everybody walks out tonight, I'll still be doing better than I was when I was drinking." And you know, because when I was drinking and doing other things, nobody wanted to be around me. I mean, I had nothing left. I had reached the wall. I mean, people didn't want to be around me, and people were afraid to even know what was happening, because if, you know, they didn't want to find out, you know, they didn't want to find me dead and have to be the one to, like, identify me and say, "Oh, yep, that's him." I'd like to welcome any newcomers here to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a wonderful, you know, place that saved my life, and I see many people in here that saved their life too, I can tell. Just a little bit. All right, so I'll tell you that when I first came in, and problem with when I came in and I was young is a lot of the old timers that were in here had already come in, and they were, you know, they had already had lives going on. You know, they were they'd already had jobs and careers and families and all kinds of things, and you know, I never had any of that. I mean, my best job was drug dealer, and I was mediocre at best at that. I was totally unsuccessful. It wasn't good at all, and I thought I was doing good, but really it was bad. So I had this issue that I had to deal with. I had to learn how to grow up, and I had to learn how to be a productive member of society. And you know, I'm still learning, you know, each time as each day goes on. I'll tell you, I grew up in Indio, so I'm from here, and I've been in most every recovery home out here. I've been in Betty Ford Center, what is now the Ranch, but it used to be Lost Heads and the ABC Club. And I went into the Betty Ford Center in March of 1987, and I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just an addict, you know. I didn't have a problem with alcohol, and I, as that goes, my relapse, which happened 2 hours out of Betty Ford Center on the airplane to the halfway house, I was ordering Michelobes on the airplane and getting crocked, you know, on the way to the halfway house. And then I landed at that, you know, they picked me up at the airport in Minneapolis, and I tell you, you know, I had like a two-hour layover in Denver, right, in Denver Airport, and there's a bar in Denver Airport and it's like the same bar every 100 feet, you know, in airports. And so I went into one bar, and I ordered a beer, and I drank half, and I'd get up and leave, and, "You're not going to finish that? I'm not an alcoholic." So then I'd walk down to the next bar, order a beer, drink half. "You're not going to finish that? I'm not an alcoholic." Well, I did that. You know, I made the rounds until I got back to the same spot. And I was pretty drunk when they picked me up. But that's pretty much how my life went, my drinking career. It wasn't fancy. I wasn't, you know, I thought I was intelligent, but really I was just not, you know, laying the game. I started getting loaded when I would say in between the eighth and ninth grade. Now, a lot of young people get, you know, that's when they do it. Some people earlier, some people a little later. But for me, I was in Catholic school. So, you know, I was pretty much ramrodded in Catholic school, although even, you know, I was an altar boy, and I thought that I should have a share of the collection plate too, because I was up there working. So, and my thinking, even before alcohol and drugs, was not square, you know. And then when I started, man, it was on. I had my progression was At first, it was, oh, this seems pretty good. I think I could like this. Then a little more progression, oh, this is good. I really like this. And then it got to, wow, this is really great. This is fantastic. I love this. Then it was, wow, things aren't getting so good anymore. And then it was like, oh, this is no good at all. And that's just how the disease went for me. And it happened in a short time from 14 years old to 21 years old. And some people, it takes a long, long time. But for me, it was just a short 7.5 years that I was getting drunk and loaded. I guess my favorite drink was Bacardi 151, not because it was, you know, anything special. You can actually light the torch with 151, but you also, when you drink it, it hits you real fast, and that was what I was all about. I needed that real fast, instant get out of it, get loaded, get drunk, get whatever I could. I started missing school, and I started, you know, I would wake up in the morning and I would leave early, and I'd go meet the guys at the tree, and we'd smoke our little marijuana joints, and then I'd go to school, and me and three other guys, we'd go into Alpha Beta, it was, next to Indio High School. I don't know what it is now, but it was Alpha Beta. And then one of us would steal a bottle of whatever we can get, usually a pint, and we'd drink down as much as we could and pass it around until it was gone or we couldn't drink anymore, and then we'd go to first period. So that's how my day started often. And it wasn't really good because, you know, we were either throwing up and getting kicked out or just leaving because it was too much. It was just too much to handle. And 14 years old, you know, 15 years old, and you're running things like that. It's, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. And it's like everybody says, if you know what, if I know today what I, oh man, it's just amazing. I had a little mishap. I went to jail or juvenile hall in the 11th grade for selling marijuana. I wasn't successful at that. There was an undercover sting operation, and I got, you know, caught in the sting and selling marijuana to an undercover officer, and went to juvenile hall. I was one of the first 25 residents of Indio Juvenile Hall. They like to say they just built it for us. You know, that was pretty much, I can say that my life, even when I was 15, was unmanageable. And that's key for me in Alcoholics Anonymous today, is, you know, I never ever thought that my life was unmanageable. I didn't understand that. And, you know, when it took a while when I came into AA to understand that, you know, just drinking and drugging and doing everything is not necessarily the problem. It's the unmanageable part of my life that keeps me going. I will say that, you know, I just thought my case was different. I just didn't believe that I had a problem. And everyone would tell me, and I even got a counselor one time to tell my parents that it was their fault I was the way I was. And I don't know if the guy's still working, but he sure co-signed my bullshit. And that kept me going on for a lot more time. You know, it kept me running and gunning. I can remember, well, at the end for me was the Comfort Inn in North Indio, the Comfort Inn there, and I was there, and it was me and another guy sitting there, and we were shooting dope and drinking Bacardi 151, and it was speed, and so we were just trying to see who would die first or pass out first or something, I don't know, because he would go, and I would go, and he would go, and I would go, and you know, I never thought I'd find myself in that position. After I got out of Betty Ford Center, I'll give you a little history real quick. I went to the halfway house, drunk. I told them, oh, I got, you know, 30 days, and I had none. And so I stayed there for 59 days. And then I had gotten a job at my 30 days. in Minneapolis and tossing pizzas at the Mall of the America in Minneapolis. All right, so here I am. I made enough money to get a plane ticket to get my ass out of Minneapolis and fly to Santa Fe, New Mexico, because I couldn't hang. My buddy there in Santa Fe, New Mexico, he was in AA. He was in Betty Ford Center with me, and he was going. He was secretary of a meeting. So he picked me up at the airport, and I told him I had 89 days when really I had 59 days, and so I was lying right out of the gate, and we went and set up chairs, and I thought, oh yeah, this AA thing is good, and moved in with them. And I'll tell you, it took about 4 weeks for me to relapse, and then I was full in it again. It was probably 4 or 5 weeks. We were living on Canyon Road at 1000 Canyon Road, which is pretty swank address in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I don't know what I was doing there, but he obviously knew, so I was going along with it. And then his sister came over, and he went and picked her up to bring her into the Betty Ford Center. And so she came in there, and she was still drugging, and she did the old, she was still smoking weed, so she would take a hit of the weed, and this is how I relapsed. So she would take a hit of the weed, and then she would kiss me and blow it into my mouth, and I wasn't getting high because I wasn't smoking it. It was just after effects. That's the way my mind works. I have this crazy mind, and that's the way that's the way my head was thinking. Well, it wasn't long, as you could tell, where I was getting awfully loaded. So about, a month and a half later, I'm on the streets in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm shooting up again, and I figure, you know what, if I'm going to be on the streets here, it's cold. It's cold in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I might as well be back out in the desert, where I know people and I can get my game on. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Santa Fe. It's the Capitol, and they have the Capitol building there, and they have these generators that generate the heat and the air and the power and everything for the Capitol building. Well, they have fins that are about that wide, and they're about that thick, and they run along the generator. And so me and all the other homeless people would get a piece of cardboard and set it on the fins, and then we'd lay, and that's where we'd sleep. And sometimes you'd got a big refrigerator box, and you could put the top over you like this, and you wake up, because it snows in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But the heat from the fins would keep you warm, and that's the way I was living my life, all right? And I thought, you could have told me, you are, my family, everybody, you guys are, you're miserable. And I would have said, nope, my case is different. I am not miserable. And I do this by choice. And I choose to be, on the streets. And so I came back to the desert, and that was the beginning of the end for me. And I remember that I ended up in that Comfort Inn, and I, of course, passed out first, and then somebody came over, and the other guy opened the door, and they stole all the dope or whatever, but they blamed it on me. And so then I got taken hostage at the Algiers Inn for, about 12 hours, and I was sitting there, and I was under guard with it was a shotgun. I don't even know if it was loaded, but it scared the shit out of me. So I told him, I said, well, I'll go to my grandparents' house, and I'll rip off something, and then that way I can pay for the, for the dope that I think I lost or got stolen or whatever. So you got to understand that for the week prior, I had been, I would sneak over to my grandparents' house, and they would go on a morning walk at 6 in the morning, every morning. And so I would wait till they would go, and then I would hop the fence, and I'd crawl through the dog door, and I'd get whatever I could, cash most of the time, or, video camera. And I've since made amends for that, by the way. And you know, and then I'd take it out, and I'd either get booze or dope or whatever was there. And most of the time, I'd start off with my bottle of you know, whatever Bacardi, vodka, whatever I could get from the guy at, you know, whatever I could get. And I went over there that day, and they dropped me off at nighttime. Well, I couldn't go in the house at night, so I had to wait, and I waited there all night long, and I waited on the side of the house, and it was cold, you know, it was, you know, getting that away, especially when all you have is shoes and shorts, and you don't own any other clothes because they stole them all. And I sat there, and I said, I'm going to go sleep in the car. They always leave their car open. Well, my grandma had this old 77 Seville, and the door, you got to open it and slam it to, you know, to get them to shut. So I didn't want to make a lot of noise and wake the dog up. So I shut it, and it didn't quite shut all the way. So I heard him come out. They walked out. They walked by the car. I heard the dog's chains jingling, and I woke up like this, and I'm all, okay, they didn't see me. And, you know, I must have been sick and tired of being sick and tired, because whether it was God had his hand down on me saying no more, or I was just ready to give up, I didn't get out of that car. I wanted to so bad. I wanted to get out of that car and go get my game on. But you know what? It just didn't happen. I fell back asleep. And probably because I've been up for 4 or 5 days. But it was a godsend to me that day. You know, of course, they came out and they found me there in the car. Here, the door's open. And my grandpa opened the door. And, oh, my God, they haven't seen me since Betty Ford Center, you know. And so they thought I was doing good. They thought I was still in New Mexico, for Christ's sakes. And here I am in their car, and I own nothing but a pair of shoes and some shorts, and I'm weighing 118 pounds. And I was looking pretty ragged. And I said, no, I'm doing fine. I'm fine. I just need to sleep. And so they took me in, and they let me sleep. And when I woke up, my mom and dad were there, and my grandma and grandpa, and, you know, they gave me the ultimatum. They said, you can either go into recovery home one more time, or we'll put you on the edge of town with $20. And I'll tell you, $20 sounded pretty damn good. But that was my second God thing. Any good alcoholic dope fiend would have took the $20 in a minute. But for some reason, I didn't. I said, okay. Just this day, man, was just, you know, I don't know. God was looking out for me on this day. So I called Betty Ford Center. They said, try Lost Heads. I called Lost Heads, and, you know, I'm knowing from the game that there's always a 30-day waiting list everywhere in every recovery home. And so I'm all right. So I got 30 more days, so, you know, at least to do good. Well, I call up there, and the guy answers the phone, and I said, yeah, I need to come in. He goes, well, when can you get here? And I said, well, what's the wait time? And he goes, well, two people didn't show up today, so we just happen to have two beds available today. When can you get up here? And I was like, I told my parents, when can I get up here? And they go, now. And so I said, now. So once again, my family dropped me off at the door of a recovery home, you know, hoping that I would get it this time. And I stayed in Lost Heads, and I stayed there for 30 days. I went out on a pass, and I came back, and then 60 days was almost up. So I started getting nervous. I had to find a place to live. I had to find, you know, something to do. I put in for a 30-day extension, and they denied me. They said, nope, no 30-day extension for you. You know the game. You got the toolbox. Go on out there and you know, you could move in with, I forget the guy's name, but, you know, he had a house down. There's always some alumni from the ranch that has a house that you could move into no matter what. I mean, no matter what time. So I get out. I move into this guy's house. And I got to move out. For some reason, something happened. So I go on down. Tim, I don't know if you guys know brother Tim, but he was down at the ABC Club when I arrived that day, and I went down to the ABC Club, and I told Danny, like everybody does, I need to get in. And he said, no. And I went, no. He says, no, there's no room. And so I was like, damn, what am I going to do? Tim tells me, he says, sleep outside on the Chase Lounge. I'm all, what? Sleep outside on the Chase Lounge. So for a few days, I'm sleeping outside on the Chase Lounge at the ABC Club, going to meetings. And the funny thing about Danny, if he sees you coming around a lot, one day he goes, you still here? I went, yeah, Danny, I'm still here. He goes, I think there's an empty spot on the floor for you. So, and I came in, and now I'm on the floor. And if you've been to the ABC Club, now it's a little different, but on the downstairs of the men's house, I guess, there used to be a couch and carpet and a living area, and so we had people living down there. And that's where everybody detoxed, so you got to sleep down there with the detoxers. And then as you progress, you move up to the floor of the rec room upstairs, and then you move up to the couch in the rec room, and then you finally get a bed about 3 weeks later is what it took for me. And, you know, I was serious about recovery. I wanted to stay sober, and things were going good. I stayed in the ABC Club. I'm kind of hurrying through this part of my story because there's a big shift I need to get to that was detrimental in my recovery that I almost didn't make it. And so I got out of the ABC Club. I'm living with my buddies, and I'm just over 2 years sober. And I didn't really know how to have a job. I didn't know how to, I couldn't do anything right except stay sober. That's the only thing I had done. And I was really into sobriety. The young people, we'd go to conventions everywhere. I mean, even if we had to hitchhike to Anaheim, we'd do it. And just to get to the conventions and hang out. And I just couldn't get it together. I'm living with these guys, and I got no job, or I would work for a week, get a paycheck, and then, not work for 3 weeks, and then, work real hard to get enough to pay the rent, and then, wouldn't work for 3 weeks, and I didn't have the rent, and I was, I didn't want these newcomers to think that, I didn't have it together. I was 2 years and 2 months, and I got my last check, and I was in Palm Springs, and I had some turnoff guys give me a ride to the bus to the apartment where I filled up two pillowcases with everything I owned, and then they gave me a ride to the Indio bus terminal, and I bought a ticket to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and this is at 2, and I didn't tell anybody. Anybody, not my family, not my friends, not my sponsor, not anybody. And I got on that bus, and I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, at 2 years and 2 months sober. So I was on the edge at that point. I didn't want to change everything. They talk about change in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to change everything. I wanted to keep a few little things. I wasn't willing to go that extra length. I wasn't willing to take advice and direction from people who are your boss and stuff like that. I thought that, I should be able to tell them how I want them to boss me around, and of course it doesn't work that way. So I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I got there. My buddy met me. He was getting loaded now, but he let me stay in his hotel. His dad was gone. Him and his dad were partners in a hotel, and so I stayed in this room. Now, it was winter in Santa Fe, so that means snow on the ground. I would wake up in the morning, and I would walk probably 2 miles to the Friendship Club, and I would go to the morning meeting. I'd raise my hand. My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. I need a job and a place to stay. And then I'd go over to St. Michael's Mission, and I'd get in the soup line at two years and 2 months sober, and get my soup line, and then I'd hang out for a little while at the club, and then I'd go to the noon meeting, and my name's John, I'm an alcoholic, I need a job and a place to stay. And I did that for a week, eating at the Mission and staying at this AA club. And there was this guy in the AA club who, his name was Bud, and he was old, and he had, you know, a million years, and he'd sit there and he said, I got shot down over the South Pacific, and you know what you need to do? You need to join the Army. And I'm all, what? You're crazy. I ain't gonna join the Army. So after a week of doing this, I had a job and a place to stay. All right? I had Anton B. from Santa Fe, New Mexico, gave me a job cleaning this little restaurant. And this other guy, I don't even remember his name anymore, let me sleep on the floor of his trailer. So there you go. I had, you know, AA saved me one more time. And so after about a month, I started thinking, man, I got to tell somebody. I got to tell somebody something. I've been here. Nobody knows where I am. My family probably thinks I'm dead. My AA friends from the desert, nobody knows what happened to me. And I said, but I can't go back and let them know I just bailed and didn't tell anybody. That would make me look like, oh no, I mean, I would have a bad program if that was the case, and I couldn't go back like that. So how am I going to save my ass and my face at the same time, which is, you know, a goal that I had to do. And I said, I know, I'll join the Army. So I go down and I join the Army thinking that I'll come home. My mother and my grandfather, who were my, you know, I had to impress them, would say, oh, you're such a good guy for finally getting your shit together, because that's all I ever heard all my life was, John, when are you going to get your shit together? When are you going to get your shit together? And I always, I don't know, I'm getting my shit. This time I have my shit together. I'm joining the Army. So God had a plan for me, that he did. And he decided that I needed to join the Army, and I went in the Army on April. I came back, and you know, everybody was miserable. I didn't save my ass or my face. So I ended up signing the paper on April 24th of 1990, and at 2.5 years sober. And I remember looking in the mirror saying, my God, what have I done? And so they shipped me off to Fort Sill. And to make a long story short, on October 7th, 1990, about 4.5 months after I was in the Army, that was my third AA birthday, by the way. I landed in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, and drove my ammo truck off a C-5 and went to war. 3 years sober, and God had a plan for me. And that was a life-changing experience. And, you know, a lot of things happened during that time, and I wish I can go into all of them. You know, there's no meetings at war, but thank God there's the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I would write, and they'd send me this Loners Internationalist meeting in print, and they didn't know who I was. They just knew I was out in the desert, in Desert Storm. And they would write back, and they put my name on the back of the sheet, and all of a sudden I'd start getting all these letters from AAs all over the world, you know, from Guam and from, you know, Puerto Rico and from Brazil, and the clerk would, when he'd do mail call, he's all, God, you know a lot of people everywhere, all over the world, don't you? And so he sat there, and you know, he'd throw me the letters, but. This one particular day, after they made me a combat medic and gave me 10 Valium injectors, that, you know, got to make me the guy, right, with the Valium injectors. Give it to me. Can't give it to Joe. You got to give it to John. So, anyways, That's another thing that, you know, they sat in the glove box and they just sat there and I never touched them. And I thought about it many, many, many times about nobody will know. I'm out in the desert. You know, I mean, the disease was kicking in overtime. You know, nobody will know. Shh, I'll be detoxed by the time I get back. Shit. So, Christmas Eve, somebody, Sergeant Mitchell, his wife sent him some vodka in a rubbing alcohol bottle. And, you know, booze was not the thing over there, although they did, everybody got a two-can ration of near beer every day. So I would save mine up, and I'd get like a 12-pack of near beer, and I'd trade it for a carton of smokes. And, I mean, you'd watch these guys drinking 12 near beers all at once trying to get a little drunk on, and I identified with that. But on this particular Christmas Eve, it was lights out, and Sergeant Mitchell came around, and I was walking back from the latrine, and he said, here, man, you want some? And he opened up his coat, and I looked at it, and, you know, it'd been a long time since I'd been to a meeting, and I smelled it, and I was like, and I went, nah. And he goes, oh, that's right, I forget, you don't drink, you're in AA, oh, I'm sorry. And then he tried to apologize for the next 10 minutes about how, you know, he shouldn't have offered it to me. But the seed was sown, and I went into my tent, and I sat on the rack, and I'm sitting there, and I'm all, nobody'll know, it's just one, nobody'll know. And I was about ready to drink that night. And let me see if I can hang. I was about ready to drink that night, and it was lights out, and I heard mail call. Mail never comes after lights out. In the mail for me was a brown envelope with the address Box 459. And in it was the book As Bill Sees It. And it saved my life that night. You know, it had some other pamphlets too, but, you know, the book As Bill Sees It, you know, who would have thought? Who would have thought that, you know, AA would have came through in a pinch. But you know what? AA has always, always, always come through in a pinch for me. And I'm sure it will for everybody else if we work it. So, the next morning, you know, I didn't drink. I read As Bill Sees It. Next morning, I'm sleeping. I'm happy. I'm content. Staff sergeant comes in, and he says, Haley, wake up. And I'm all, oh, Merry Christmas, Sarge. I'm all happy. He goes, Merry Christmas. It's your turn to burn the shit. So it's supposed to be a funny joke. So I had to go out, and I had to pull out the barrels and light MoGas. And Christmas morning, I'm out there burning everybody. Shit. So God has a plan for me. I stayed sober through the Army, and I got out, and I came back, and I was, you know, I had a new lease on life. I had a new lease on life, and I know that, you know, at that point in time, I decided that I was going to actually do the seventh step and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings, because I wasn't willing to do that. You know, I had worked all the steps a million times and, you know, three different recovery homes, but I never actually wanted to change 100%. And from that day on, I decided to change. And it took a while, took a couple years, but eventually I developed a work ethic through Alcoholics Anonymous and having people, you know, help me out. I moved away to go to school. I moved away. I went to school in Fullerton, and I drove to Sound School in North Hollywood. And I guess some things never change. I was at an AA club, and there was a dance, and of course that's where I met my wife. And I know this isn't going to sound too good to some people, but she had one day. And she wasn't my wife at that point, but I had grand plans. And so, grand scheming plans. And she went out and had to get loaded for a little while longer. And, I hung with it. And today we've been married 4 years. We've been married, and we have a young child who is 14 months old, and he's just the light of my life. During that time, I started my own company, and it's working out, and my family's working out, and I just never today I have a life that I never thought I'd have. I don't know how to be any more grateful for the life I have today than to just say, thank God for AA. I mean, that's just, so much has happened in my life, all the things that I did and didn't do when I was growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous, all played a part in the person I am today. You work the steps, and then the steps eventually work you. You get a sponsor who knows you, and I've had a couple. I had my sponsor of 33 years get loaded on pills just about 6 months ago and go out. And so he had a good program. He sponsored about 20 guys, and every month there's a sponsor meeting that we'd all go to. And who knows? Who knows? The disease is tricky. And, having the group of guys together, we still meet. We don't necessarily have them as our sponsor anymore, but we still meet, and we still do the deal, and we help each other, and that's really important in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really important to help not only the newcomer, but as in my case, when you got a little bit of time and things just aren't good, and if you got a little bit of time and things just aren't good and you're afraid, your ego won't let you let somebody know, man, you got to let it out, because if you don't let it out, a closed mouth doesn't get fed. If you don't let it out that you're hurting, no matter how much time you got, you could end up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or the Army, or who knows. But most likely, you'll end up drunk again. And I know that's not where I want to be. That's not where I want to be, and I'm sure it's not where a lot of people in this room want to be. So, it's really important to ask for help and to give help when needed. That's pretty much, one of the driving factors in my sobriety today. On the back of the chip, it says, to thine own self be true. And I never understood that. I mean, I understood it, but I never delved into it deep enough to understand that. And I got to thinking, out of all the slogans in AA, they choose that one, to thine own self be true, to put on the back of the chip. Must mean something. It must mean something really, really, really important. And you know what? I did thinking, and I looked at that, and there was times where I compromised my morals in recovery, definitely while I was getting drunk, but in recovery, I've compromised sometimes, and I wasn't true to myself. And those times are when I came closest to getting drunk again. And, you know, if it wasn't for a higher power that knows me better than me and believes in me even when I don't believe in him most of the time. Actually, I just get amazed. I if God seems far away, who moved? And you know, that's an old saying, and of course I did. And not recently, but in the last couple years, I got involved and I moved far away from God, to where my sponsor said, he goes, just how far can a guy get away from God and still stay sober? And I was all, I don't know. And I wasn't praying, and I didn't remember the time he saved my life in Iraq. I didn't remember the time he saved my life in my grandma's car in Bermuda Dunes. And I tend to forget those things. It's really important for me to maintain some contact. And I try to do that today. You know, I try to, when I'm driving, I try to at least check in with my higher power. And I know there was times when I never did that. And I still stayed sober. But it sure was hard. It sure was hard. And I guess I'll close with a little thing that I saw on a shirt at the San Diego World Convention. I think it was in, I don't remember what year it was in San Diego, but it said, AA may not save the whales or make the world last. It may not even save your soul, but it sure will save your ass. Thanks.
Thank you, John, very much. This meeting, as well as all the speaker meetings, are taped. The tapes will be on sale and available for immediate pickup after each meeting at the tape table. We respectfully ask there be no saving of seats in any of the meetings. If you're not sitting in it, it is available. Okay. Everyone is welcome to stay for the Young People's Dance with DJ starting right after the opening meeting tonight. Let's thank John again. Very good speech. Awesome. Okay. Let's see. After a moment of meditation, will Lisa please lead us in the Lord's Prayer? That's it.